Hi, this is Paul. I'm excited about this video. Let's jump in. Let's go back to this moment. I think in terms of the Vancouver conversations between Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, or the four talks that they did on video, this moment was the most important one. And you've noticed I've played this a lot. I've played it in a lot of different settings. But this, I think, is in many ways the climax of their conversation.
It's one of the elemental claims in the Old Testament is that you're not even supposed to utter the name of God, because by defining it too tightly, you lose its essence. And so,
okay, so Peterson, I'd nuance what he just said there, but the recognition in the Old Testament of the prohibition of making a graven image of God is a recognition and an assertion that nothing that we can encounter within the created order can be an adequate representation of God. Okay? That's what stands behind the commandment to not make a graven image, because any attempt to make a representation of God is a diminishment and a reduction of God. That's the assertion and assumption of the Ten Commandments, of the Hebrew Scriptures, of Christianity, of Islam, of the whole Abrahamic tradition.
So let's not be talking about what the classical definition of God is here, okay? It's a historical non-starter.
Okay,
and there's plenty of...
And this is where my God number one and God number two came out of, because Sam wanted to say that essentially God is this man who lives in the sky and is judging people, and that's the representation of God. Now, very understandable how Sam would come up with a representation like that. You can find it in the Sistine Chapel. It's kind of a default representation. And, you know, when Jesus calls God Father, this is where we tend to go with it. We tend to image God in that way. Now, Christianity has always said that that's a reduction of what Christianity asserts God is, but that makes a very nice straw man for someone like Sam Harris to poke fun at.
Can I check in with the audience?
Okay, is the audience, right? Checking things.
So, can I jump in here?
You're sacrificing your Q&A.
So, Peterson, yeah, that is at the expense of Q&A. That's what you're giving up. Yeah. But I think it's probably worth it. So, let me say, Sam, I do not believe in a supernatural God. But the God that I heard Jordan just describe, I do not have any difficulty understanding why he might care if you masturbate, and I also don't have any trouble figuring out how he might answer prayers.
Well, tell me more then.
Well, I can tell you how a prayer might be answered.
Okay, but these are...
you could let me do that.
It'll be interesting, so... I'm not Jordan. We've not talked about this. If I heard an answer from him that actually would satisfy me as to what the mechanism of action might be, that
mechanism of action. Pay attention there. Now, that's what we're looking for, right? We're looking for a machine, a mechanism of action, something that can turn on its own and act in predictable ways, so predictable, in fact, that for all practical purposes, we call them always to have a cause and effect linkage. This is, of course, the heart of science, and that's what they're trying to do.
That'd be pretty interesting. And if he can tell me what I heard, I think it would suggest that we're not just making up stories here.
Okay, you might like this, maybe not, but, well, it's possible. Okay, so imagine that. Okay, so let's imagine that hellish situation that you laid out. Okay, but let's put the extra twist in it, because one of the things that we both decided, I think, was that you also have to build in the intent into that. So let's say the hell that we're talking about isn't the victim of the terrible massacres that you laid out in the jungle story, but a perpetrator. Okay, so someone who's actually acted in a malevolent manner, truly malevolent manner. Okay, or maybe perhaps we wouldn't have to take that extreme case. We could say, well, perhaps you've decided that you've decided that you've seriously done something wrong, okay, and that you want to get away from hell, you want to make things better. Okay, so here's an exercise you can try. So what you do is you sit on the edge of your bed and you say, okay, what I did was wrong. And you have to really believe this, right? So you've thought about it, it's killing you. It's killing you. So now you're penitent and you're confessing, let's say, and you're confessing to yourself as much as to anyone. And you say, I really want to know what I did wrong. And I really want to know what I could do to put it right. And I'm willing to accept any answer that will manifest itself to me.
Now what he's done, he's spoken into the void at the edge of his bed. And he's willing, he's waiting for an answer. Now he's alone in the room. There's not another person in the room. The assumption is his dog or his cat isn't going to answer him. The little statue on the bookshelf isn't going to answer him. He's there, sitting at the edge of his bed, looking into the void, being real about himself, being real about his situation, and he speaks it out. Maybe he doesn't even speak it verbally, he just speaks it in his mind, and he puts it out there.
Try that. See what happens. That's a prayer that will be answered, and it won't be answered in the way that you want it to be answered. I can bloody well tell you that.
Okay, but that...
Well, what are you communicating with?
What are you communicating with?
Communicating with when
no,
you do
no,
that.
No, that is something that... That is a process that I'm familiar with. It doesn't require any supernatural explanation. And it certainly...
Now let's pay attention to these little lines that we're drawing here. Natural, supernatural. What do we mean by these words?
It certainly doesn't require that we imagine that any of our books were dictated by the creator of the universe.
I didn't say that.
And that's really a straw man, Sam.
It required any supernatural explanation, or that it required the book. I was asked to provide an instance of prayer that worked, and that's what I did. I didn't do anything other than that.
That's fully understandable in terms of human psychology. And
it's not understandable because we don't know where the answer comes from.
Well, we don't know where anything comes from.
That's true.
Yeah, okay, so...
There they can agree. We don't know where the answer comes from. We don't know where anything comes from. That's true. On that, we can't agree. So where do things come from? The big part of what I've been thinking about lately, and you heard me talk about this with John Vervaeke, you heard me try to get into it with Nathan Jacobs. So you have the world of matter and you have the world of mind, and these two things have been radically disconnected. The mind in ourselves and John Vervaeke in his long series on the meaning crisis has been laying this thing out. And we're up to video like 29, and you know, I'm loving it. I love a long thing. So, you know, 29, and here we're going through it. But one of my favorite episodes is his episodes on the Romantics. And he gets into Kant. And this really does get into what we're going at. Now, one of the things that I noted was that all up until here in Vancouver 1 with Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris with Brett Weinstein in the middle, Brett didn't say too much at the whole beginning of the thing. What Peterson is doing is in a sense laying out Kantian terms. He's trying to school Sam Harris in Kant. And of course, Sam Harris doesn't want to be schooled in anything, so he just kicks over whatever Jordan tries to construct there. But Jordan is laying out Kant here. And it was very interesting in some of the early Bishop Barron, before they had their conversation, some of the early Bishop Barron comments on Jordan Peterson, how often Bishop Barron noted Kantian frameworks and Kantian thought in Jordan Peterson. And, I didn't put that link in. I hate when I don't do that.
I mean, I don't want to trespass on your time. This video series is already long, but we're moving through titanic figures here, and it always... I feel a difficult thing to do, but I want to talk about the figure of Kant, and we'll talk about Kant in a couple places, so I need to introduce him here anyways. So Kant is trying to deal with this fracturing in realness that Descartes has left, right? And the two sides, the inner subjective mind touching itself and the outer mathematical. And Kant brings up a question that...
Now, the inner subjective mind touching itself, I think therefore I am, and if you go back and you listen to his episodes on Descartes, there's this, okay, I can't deny myself, cognito ergo sum. I think, therefore, I am. I can't deny it, but that's the I. There's always an I. I as in the letter I, not as I and E-Y-E and the eye of Sauron. There's always an I, and I'm touching myself and I can't doubt there. But then there's the world of math outside of me.
It's very important. And there's been other people who have given voice to this. And this is an important one, which is, how is it that math is so good at describing reality? Why just accept Galileo's claim that it's the language of the universe? At one point, we had an answer to why math is so descriptive of reality. We had the Neoplatonic answer, the idea that reality is ultimately grounded in intelligible form, and those intelligible forms, you remember the eidos, the structural functional organizations, are ultimately abstract, eternal, etc., and that's the ultimate grounding. That's why many people who are realists in mathematics formally and explicitly label themselves as Platonists, because that is a way of trying to explain how mathematics gives you access to reality when it is nothing like spatio-temporal material reality. I mean, why is it that something like math describes physics so well? And what Kant was really trying to get at is, how do I get those two sides of Descartes together? How do I get the side that says math is real, but all I have, math gives me access to reality, but all I really have is access to my own mind? How do I get those together? And Kant comes up with a really radical proposal. He calls it a Copernican revolution. He thinks it's as important as Copernicus' revolution of the external world. And the Kantian proposal is a very interesting one, because what I think it does is it really radicalizes things even more. So Kant's proposal is, these categories, these patterns of intelligibility we find in the world, the mathematical properties, aren't actually there. Not in the sense we think they are. So what Kant does is he basically makes use of a move that Occam made. If you remember, Occam's razor, and remember I often say people don't understand what they're invoking when they invoke Occam's razor. Occam's razor basically says that all these patterns of intelligibility you think are in the world are actually in your mind, right? What Kant does is says, well, these ways of measuring the world mathematically, they aren't the features of the world. They are the way in which experience has to be organized in order to make sense to the mind. So let me try and give you an analogy for understanding that, right? So I'm going to do a reverse on the analogy you see me use when we were talking about Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, right? So let's do it the other way around. The world is very blurry. There's too much. And so what I have to do is I have to filter it.
Now, that is basically the argument that Peterson had been making to Sam Harris throughout Vancouver 1. There's too much of the world, and so we have to filter it. This is from Kant.
I have to filter it so that it will fit my eye, and my brain and eye can make sense of it.
And in fact, the world is filtered. We only see certain wavelengths of light. We don't see infrared. And the world is filtered by our capacity to pick up things by the senses that we have.
So these filters have to be put into place. And so Kant's idea was, there are structures in the mind that basically act as these filtering frames. It's kind of both a combination of a filter and a frame. And what they do is they impose a structure of intelligibility on experience. So this is opposite to the Platonic. This is why it's a Copernican revolution. It's a complete reversal of the Platonic model.
In other words, the Platonic model, there's already the structure out there, and we have the ability to apprehend it. This is, as he said, a reversal of it, We are imposing a structure of intelligibility on the world. We have to do this in order to engage the world.
So the idea is, I'm not discovering the patterns of intelligibility that structurally, functionally organize the world. What's actually happening is this, right? This pattern is being imposed on the information coming in so that it will fit my mind and make sense to my mind. And that's the basis of my capacity for reasoning about the world. I can reason about the world, not because the world is ultimately rationally structured, but like Occam said, the world is absurd in itself. I can reason about the world because I have filtered it in such a way that my mind can process it according to its own internal grammar.
Now, this is a very interesting flip, especially when you think about a guy like Sam Harris, because it seems Sam Harris is sort of a naive realist that imagines, well, okay, the world is full of objects. We simply apprehend them. We simply manipulate them. So Sam Harris's view of the world is, it seems to me, and I may be wrong, so go ahead and correct me in the comment section, that the world is a fairly simple place of objects, and we apprehend them, and we manipulate them, and through science we know them, and we can make predictions, and we can use these tools, and we can go about our business making the world a better, in fact, a perfect place. That's sort of Sam Harris's thing. Now, this is an inversion of that in a sense, you know, via Kant here, the world is, and Verveke's going to get there, the world is sort of trapped in our minds, and that's the only world we're actually dealing with. Now, what's interesting about this with respect to Sam Harris, by the time Sam Harris gets to questions like freedom of the will, or whether we have a will at all, we are, in a sense, sort of like victims of Lou Gehrig's disease. We're delusional victims of Lou Gehrig's disease. We're sort of trapped in ourselves, and we're living in fantasy worlds in which we act as if, and we imagine we're making decisions, but we're actually just living out a certain script of determinism that has been set from the foundation of the world. This is something that Calvinists shouldn't feel too squeamish about, I suppose, or certain kinds of Calvinists, but it almost gets to be a picture like that. And as John Verveke is about to unfold, he's going to say, here via Kant, we become really prisoners of the world within our minds.
So see how this is why it's a Copernican reversal. I'm not discovering in the world the mathematical properties of things. My mind is filtering and imposing a structure on them so that it can make sense and think about them. So you have to take this word and this phrase and make it really, really strong. Your mind is making sense of things.
Making sense. The mind actually senses something that the mind produces. It's not something that the mind is discerning. It's not patterns that the mind is seeing. The patterns are coming from the mind, again, via Occam. This is nominalism. And I think Nathan Jacobs in my conversation with him laid that out nicely. This is the way that the mind is ordering the world. This gets into some of these presuppositional questions as to whether or not the world is truly chaos, and we're just somehow powerful creatures that are able to impose sort of a delusional order on it, or that the world is in fact ordered, and we are able to perceive this order. That's one of these great divides that we're always dealing with when we're talking about these things. And in many ways, these divides can't be answered by science or by data. These are the assumptions we are bringing to the data. These are our presuppositions.
When we talk about relevance, we're going to see that there's a deep way in which Kant is, I think, right. And you say, okay, so yeah, I see how he's sort of completely inverting the world from Plato. I get that, right? So math isn't discovering reality. Math is ultimately about how the mind imposes a structure on reality so it can reason about it. Great. All right? What does that mean? Well, notice We've got now the mind. Remember, we talked about this model of the contact with the world being withdrawn, and it's being withdrawn inside the mind by Luther, and then it's being withdrawn really by Descartes. Now, not only is it withdrawn, it's imprisoned. The mind is in here, and all that can get in here always has to pass through this filtering frame. And for Kant, that means we can never know the world as it is in itself. As he famously said, the thing in itself. We can never know the world as it is. This is why, of course, the Cartesian search for certainty is going to be completely undermined. Right? So ultimately, notice how this is all coming together. The mind is ultimately only really touching itself. It has no contact now with the world. It's not only withdrawn from the world, it's isolated and trapped within itself. But it does answer the question, well, why does math work so well? Well, math works so well, according to Kant, because that's the grammar of how our minds operate.
Now, of course, a bunch of engineers are going to jump in and say, whoa, bridges stay up. But just continue to follow along in the conversation.
That's why math, which seems such a mental and abstract and weird thing, seems to make the world, seems to give us access to the structure of the world. It's not really giving us structure to the access of the world. It's creating a structure in the world of experience that is makes sense to human beings. Now that's, right, that's a really big price to pay. The price you pay for getting the two sides of Descartes back together is to get them both inside the mind and to be radically, radically out of touch with the world now. So you can imagine that people are upset with this. This is a very challenging idea. There's going to be some really important responses to this. There's going to be the Romantics and Hegel, but I want to concentrate on the Romantic solution because I've already mentioned it, and we'll talk a little bit about Hegel when we talk about Marx. So there's an idea here, right, that's sort of implicit in Kant, right? There's an idea of, right, information coming in from the world, right? So the problem with this diagram is it's too simplistic. So think of the filter as having sort of levels of processing, right? There's the raw information from the thing in itself, and it's getting processed, it's coming in, right? And then there's all of this structure being imposed on it.
And again, in terms of the Jordan Peterson-Sam Harris conversation, that's most of the early part of Vancouver 1. In fact, most of the series, Jordan Peterson is trying to school Sam Harris on Kant, and Sam Harris doesn't want to be schooled on anything.
Now this, by the way, is the most prevalent model in most of cognitive psychology and cognitive science, where you see this Kantian grammar of trying to understand the mind is in current contrast between bottom-up processing versus top-down. So the idea of bottom-up processing, we talked about this when we talked about attention, right, is this is processing that starts in perception and moves towards cognition. Top-down is processing that starts in cognition, starts from your knowledge, and moves down into perception. Remember, we talked about this when we talked about how you do this, right? The cat, right? You see this as an H and this as an A. And how do you do that? Well, you use the knowledge of the word to disambiguate the letters, and you use the knowledge of the letters to construct the word, and the two are completely interpenetrating in a completely self-organizing manner outside of your cognitive awareness. It actually makes your reading possible for you. It's a condition on the possibility of you reading. And so, right, this is the same model here. The mind is imposing a structure, and it's filtering and framing and structuring the information coming in from the world. So this Kantian model is pervasive through all of cognitive science, and for good reason. It turns out to be a very, very powerful way of looking at things. But
And I think, again, this is part of the reason why Peterson keeps pushing it on to Sam Harris. And Sam Harris simply wants to go to some sort of naive realism and maintain himself there.
As I move this way, as I move into the mind, right, as I get inside the framework, my cognition, of course, becomes more and more rational, becomes more and more mathematically, logically intelligible. But think about it. Notice you've got this weird idea now. As my processing becomes more rational, more logically mathematical, I'm actually getting farther and farther away from being in contact with the world.
Now, if you've just been listening to this instead of watching it, the diagrams are really helpful in this part of the lecture that he's giving, because he's noting that what happens, what rationality becomes in Kant, is a reflection of this pre-ordering and structuring and filtering that the mind is doing. In other words, rationality isn't actually out there in the world. Rationality is something that we are imposing on the data so that it fits cohesively and fits within the structure of our mind. In other words, rationality is simply a function of our perception again. So this looks like nominalism in the classic form. The world actually isn't any rationality out there in the world. There is only rationality in our minds. And so rationality itself is sort of a delusion.
Now, isn't that notice the Platonic aversion, the Platonic, right, reversion, like a complete reversal of the Platonic structure, is bringing with it a reverse consequence. So for Plato, as you pursue rationality, you move deeper and deeper into reality.
And you move deeper and deeper into God. You can really see that in C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles. The relationship between rationality and God is sort of pretty tight in that book. And rationality is, in a sense, Lewis's sacrament as he gets closer to God. But now for nominalists, it's completely the reverse. Rationality is a language or a system that we impose on the raw data that's coming in. It's a function of the filter. And it's sort of like those little plastic red filters that you would look at the picture in a magazine, a kid's magazine, and you would see a different picture because it would filter out all the blue or something like that.
But for Kant, right? Notice as I move more and more into rationality, I'm moving away from being in contact with reality.
Become the thing itself. Now, one of the things that I've noted is, again, this is precision in language. Reality is a pretty fudgy word, and sometimes we use it synonymously with sort of materialism, and sometimes we use it synonymously with sort of whatever it is out there that finally is true and governs and rules. And this is where I get into my definition of my working definition of this word real. Did I say rationality or real? Real, which is real, is that which governs. Real is that which finally endures. Real is that which is finally revealed. Apocalypse is finally revealed and shown to be the thing that is not moved. We are not as real as things out there. When it comes, you know, we might say, well, a bullet is more real than me because a bullet can end my life, but the thing that governs the bullet, the hand on the trigger, or a sword is more real, but the hand that holds the sword and decides where to wield the sword. And this is where we get into this continual challenge and competition between mind and matter, that matter seems to always be governing us, and in an emergent system where mind is simply a function of matter, well, then matter comes about to then rule, mind comes about to then rule matter and wield matter. And this is where we get this constant back and forth between these two forces.
Now, what comes to mind is, well, isn't the opposite then the case? And think about how this is going to make Freud and Jung possible. I mean, you know how you get Carl Jung? Take Kant. If you don't know Kant, stop talking about Jung. because Jung repeatedly tells his readers, I'm a neo-Kantian, I'm through and through a Kantian. He tells you that repeatedly. And so if you don't know Kant, shut up about Jung, because you're not understanding Jung properly. The way you get Jung is you take Kant and you take Kant's epistemology and you add it to Gnostic mythology, and that's how you get, that's the equation for Jung.
Now the Gnostic is, this is a critical point, because, Gwen, I've been having to get acquainted with Jung to one degree or another, and once he said this, it suddenly made sense, and Strawn sent me an email today. That Strawn is my friend in South Africa, who actually was the one who pointed me to Verveke in the first place. And Strawn made the point, he said, you know, notice how reluctant Jung was to talk about metaphysics. Well, why would that be? Well, if you're a Kantian, you're in a sense a prisoner in your mind. And so, of course you can't talk about metaphysics, because you can't talk about metaphysics because you're a Kantian. You can't know the thing in itself. You're in a sense a prisoner of your mind. Now you add Gnostic mythology to this, and now when we look at the dualism between matter and mind, Gnosticism is basically the making matter second class radically to mind. And this is why the Gnostic Gospels, for example, didn't have a resurrection of Jesus as the canonical Gospels do, because it made no sense to have Jesus once again take on flesh and to have that flesh ascend. It made more sense to have, for example, in the Gospel of Judas, to have Judas be the hero of the story, because what Judas did was release Jesus from his material frame, and so he could then go up and be pure spirit. It's very Greek, and that's in a sense the final tension between Christianity, which has its roots in Genesis 1, where God declares materiality good, and Gnosticism, where a secondary God created materiality, and the best God lives in spirit, untouched by decay and all of these things below. And so this point about Jung is important, because I think part of what has made this Jordan Peterson moment, I think, is the fact that it is very easy to hear Jung as a traditional theist in some ways. But if Jung is working from the prison of Kant's framework, well, Gnosticism fits in quite nicely then, because in a sense, we all go on in our heads. And in fact, Gnosticism then, as a presuppositional commitment, helps give a much more pleasing universe to this Kantian moment. But as Verveke just said, this sets up Freud and Jung. And I want to replay that, because this is a critically important point.
Because you that repeatedly, neo-Kantian, I'm through and through. You're not going to make the case. And think about how this is going to make Freud and Jung possible. I mean, you know how you get Carl Jung? Take Kant. If you don't know Kant, stop talking about Jung. Because Jung repeatedly tells his readers, I'm a neo-Kantian. I'm through and through a Kantian.
If you go back to my conversation with John Verveke, you know, part of the reason I usually do a little biographical work when I begin a relationship, as it's such, on this channel, is that there are always tidbits that are important. And you'll notice in John's early life, he, like many others in the kinds of spaces that he's familiar with, you know, spent a lot of time in Jung. And you don't hear him talk about Jung, not like Peterson does. And so, I don't know, I'm sure we'll hear more about this.
He tells you that repeatedly. And so if you don't know Kant, shut up about Jung, because you're not understanding Jung properly.
And John doesn't, you know, it's very interesting when John gets really direct about things. He's, and this is the way we all work. There are things, we all have areas that we can be pretty hard-lined on and areas we can be pretty flexible on. And it's very interesting that he makes this point so strongly.
The way you get Jung is you take Kant and you take Kant's epistemology and you add it to Gnostic mythology, and that's how you get, that's the equation for Jung. So why do I say this? Well, think about this, because if I go the other way, if I open the mind up to these more irrational, less fully processed parts of cognition, the boundary between the conscious and the unconscious aspects of my experience, as I move into the right, the imaginary, irrational, dreamlike aspects of my cognition, I'm going to lose rationality. But notice what I'm gaining. I'm gaining back that lost contact with the world. Lachman talks about this in a really good book called The Lost Knowledge of the Imagination, right? And so I think this is a misunderstanding. But notice what's going on here. And this is why my attitude towards the Romantics is so ambivalent. They're picking up on Pascal. They're trying to recapture the lost perspectival, participatory, right, knowledge, the actual involved contact with reality. But because they're inside this Kantian framework, the way that's going to happen is by moving into, right, the depths of the irrational aspects of the mind, because those are the parts of the mind that are closer to reality. And so, of course, what Jung and Freud are going to do is they're going to take that, what the Romantics do about how to reach out into the world, and they're going to make it, well, at least for Freud, it's completely reaching down into the psyche. For Jung, it's reaching down into the psyche and back out into the world. We'll come back to that later. So this...
And now, listen to the... I think this is one of the best episodes, is his episodes on the Romantics. And then the one that comes, the clash or the crash. I don't remember which one he episode. But I think these were some of the best episodes, I think, of the series that I've seen with John. Now, Pascal has sort of haunted me through this, because he mentions Pascal a few times, and so this put Pascal on my, you know, raised him to the top of my hierarchy. And a number of you have mentioned Sadler and his philosophy. And so one of the things that I did was I went to YouTube and I searched Pascal, and I noticed that Sadler had a group of interesting videos, short videos on this. And on Pensees. Now, Pensees is a book that I've wanted to read for a long time, and I haven't really done it. It's been sitting on my shelf for a very long time, but my ADHD self, different things run up the hierarchy too fast, and I don't necessarily follow through, as you well know if you follow my channel. But it's a very interesting treatment of Pensees, and this very interesting treatment of Pascal, where he talks about the mathematical mind and the intuitive mind. Now, those are the terms that Sadler is putting on. And now, when he puts it up in the original language, you have the esprit de géométrique and the esprit de finesse. Well, that's very interesting. And what I noted right away was the relationship between the two-hemisphere brain from Ian McGilchrist, and the left brain, which is unmapped territory, and the right brain, which is mapped territory. And again, this is probably a simplification, but it's the recognition that we're always moving between these two realms. And so I wanted to play, I don't know if, you know, we'll see how this goes, if YouTube will kvetch.
The principles, he says, when we actually do look at them, turn out to be quite clear. They turn out to be understandable, at least for the person who's willing to apply him or herself.
Now this he's talking about math, and that, well, you can learn math, and you can, you know, again, the question with Kant was, why does math work? Well, the radical answer is that, well, the math is just part of the brain. Math is housed in the brain. Rationality is, but it's all working in your brain. And this is via a filter from the outside. Now Pascal says that we kind of have two minds when we approach the world. And one is the mathematical mind, the esprit de géométrie, and the other is the esprit de finesse. And And now the math is sort of these are the operations. These are the mechanisms. This is the Sam Harris scientific method, the rationality. This is the right brain Ian McGilchrist. And this is something that, well, it takes a little bit of work. And if you're not weak-minded, he'll talk about this in this video. But if you're strong-minded and you develop your mathematical mind, you can find and look out at the world and find these processes and via action, you can implement them.
And the mathematical mindset uses those principles and processes of reasoning and definitions and axioms, the sort of, you know, reasoning processes that begin from these clear starting points, and you show your work along the way, and then you get to the end and it makes sense and you can sort of trace your way back.
And now this is really important. In another video, Verveke talks about this kind of in one of the later videos when he's getting into cognitive science, you know, we like these algorithms where, well, here's what we're starting with, and this is where we want to end. And so we go through this process and we achieve the outcome we want. And this is the mathematical mind. This is the mechanistic picture. This is, and via our mathematical mind, this is what we wish to do so that the mind can, now via math and engineering and science and all these things, the mind can therefore have dominion over matter and at least the world that is all of these processes. Okay, so we're a little bit ways from Kant here. We're all stuck in our mind, but we imagine we're engaging out there in the world. This is the world of physics. This is the world of engineering. This is the world of science. This is the world of technology. This is the world of tools. This is the world of opportunity. Now, we're not getting into that which we want, okay? But we're getting into, we'll look at René Girard in the future, I think. But this is the world of outcomes. This is the world that we have been longing for.
That's what, in fact, the mathematical mindset looks like. And it's, like I said, not just a matter of mathematics. Anything that you could formalize in that way where adequate performance would result from following the rules, following the reasoning processes, not getting those sorts of things wrong, really fits into the mathematical mindset. Now, by contrast, let's talk about the intuitive mind or the esprit de finesse. When we have an English cognate term to finesse something, right? When you finesse a relationship, or you finesse a negotiation, or you are trying to break into a place and you use some finesse to open up the lock or something like that. What are you doing? You're kind of feeling your way to the right solution, to what makes the best sense given those circumstances. And in this case, Pascal says the principles are found in common use. The average person could, in fact, have the intuitive mind. Many don't, of course. Like I said, many lack either of these, according to Pascal. But the intuitive mind grasps these principles in a way different than the mathematical mind or different from the ordinary person. Why? Because the principles, as he says, are subtle. He uses other terms like fine. They are somewhat difficult to grasp. Sometimes it takes some experience. Sometimes it takes looking at it from different points of view and thinking it through. We'll talk about some examples, but I just want to give you one right now. When you think about tasting, when you're making a dish and you're cooking, say, a sauce, you taste from time to time, and you're like, you know, I think that needs a little bit more salt. How much salt, the mathematician would ask? A dash. Now, a dash, of course, that's a matter of finesse. That's not a matter of mathematics.
And you hear, you know, McGilchrist, the left and right. Now, remember, for McGilchrist, the left, the esprit de finesse, the spirit of finesse, that's esprit, that's spirit. The spirit of finesse. Now, you might have thought that somehow I've forgotten where we started with Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris. What they do when they sit at the edge of the bed and they look down into the void is they're wondering about spirit. Well, what is spirit? Well, spirit is this black box, this person. Okay? Persons are spirits. And in many ways, they're black boxes to the mind of, to the spirit of math. The spirit of math is the spirit of machinery and the clockwork and cogs and gears and processes and outcomes and patterns that are never broken. And when we get a little bit deeper into C.S. Lewis's Discarded Image, we're going to look at the metaphor of law. Now, this is a very strange metaphor for this type of thing, because when we say the law of nature, it's a thing that we say, well, this cannot be broken. But when we say the law of humanity, the law and the books, well, they're broken all the time. You have a speed limit. Well, that's the law. 65 miles an hour is the law, but it's broken all the time. Now, you might say the speed of light is the law. So therefore, it's never broken, unless, of course, you listen to Sheldrake, and he says, well, it moves around a little bit. I'm not going to go there right now. But this is the point. So you have the mind, you have the spirit of math, and you have the spirit of finesse. Now, one of the interesting things about the spirit of math and the spirit of finesse is the difference of time. Because as he says, well, maybe you've got the recipe dialed in, and so you know down to the grain how much salt must be in order to achieve the outcome. That's the spirit of math. Finesse says, I'm going to put a little in, and I'm going to taste. I'm going to put a little in, and I'm going to taste. Now, that's where you have your math territory. That's the spirit of math. We know exactly how many grains to put in the recipe. The spirit of finesse is, well, we don't know how many grains. And so this is where you get the subtraction story of secularism that Charles Taylor lays out so beautifully, in that, well, it seems to be the fact that, it's kind of the older conception before Thomas Kuhn, the history of scientific revolutions, it seems to be the fact that the spirit of math just keeps pushing back the borders on the spirit of finesse. And once we get it dialed in, the number of grains of salt dialed in that make the soup exactly how it's supposed to taste. Well, now we've almost got a Platonic form in terms of the soup or the beauty. Well, where is that coming from? Well, at that point, then, you know, so these two are in competition. And so, again, you look at McGilchrist. Well, we use the unmapped territory until a territory can be mapped. And so we go from the spirit of finesse. When something is a black box, when it's unknowable, to the spirit of math, when we finally learned it. When we're learning to drive, it's the spirit of finesse. And then when we finally learn to drive and it becomes map territory, now it's just the spirit of math. And so what we seem to always want to do, well, why do we want to do this? What we always want to do is turn as much as we can into the spirit of math so we can achieve the outcomes we want. That, of course, leaves over here the question of, why do we want what we want, and where does that wanting come from, and why do we think that such and such a state is good and such is bad? And again, Sam Harris seems increasingly to have a spirit of naivete, that somehow everyone agrees on the good and everyone agrees on the bad. Well, maybe a lot of us agree on most of the good and a lot of us agree on most of the bad, but that's a spirit of finesse. That's not a spirit of math. Now, let's talk more about these spirits. Jordan Peterson, I didn't seek it out, because sometimes seeking out these things takes so much time and I don't always have the time, but it's in my head. He asked the question, what is a car? Well, a car is a black box that gets you from A to B. People name their cars. People talk to their cars. People most often talk to their cars when they're anxious about the car breaking down. Now, suddenly, when the car breaks down, it's the spirit of complexity. Now, I haven't read much of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, but right away at the beginning of the book, they have this dichotomy between people who work on the bikes themselves and people who take it to the mechanic. The mechanic is, in that sense, a magician, a sorcerer. He is the one who knows the secret magic of the engine. The person who works on the engine themselves, well, they then become their own sorcerer, and they have the spirit of math with which they address the car. Now, what we're seeing here is that our approach, which is either the spirit of finesse or the spirit of math, pretty much very, very much maps onto this question of person or machine, and how we act towards an entity. The car is a, well, as long as it's getting us from A to B reliably, well, it's just a machine. It's just a conveyance. Once the car breaks down, well, now suddenly we're talking to it and we're praying about it. And we're suddenly we require the spirit of finesse, which is something that is going to unfold in time. In fact, if you go back to Jordan Peterson's one conversation with Matt Dillahunty, they have a very interesting section when they're talking about whether or not Matt Dillahunty is going to talk to his lawnmower. And this seems like just a throwaway section, but this has everything to do with the question about God. I didn't pull it up, but there's an interesting video where you basically have three science types who are saying that mathematically there's a problem with Darwinism. What do you mean there's a problem with Darwinism? Mathematically, there's not actually enough time for randomness to yield life in this world. And you can look at James Tour's videos where he's a biochemist, where he says basically, we have no idea how we made this jump from non-life to life, from inorganic to organic. And now when we invoke this word randomness, well, there's your black box. Well, that's the spirit of finesse. Well, it's trial and error, and it's blind. It's without intention. And the more of these conversations that I listen to between atheists and theists, between people who say the world is a product of random accident, what we're really debating is intentionality and mindfulness in terms of the processes that have created the world. We want to know, now we're back to matter and mind. We want to know if the world started without mind, only matter, and mind is an emergent property, or if the world started with mind, more of a classic theistic, and then produced and organized matter and pattern. And now, if you go back a few videos, John Vervaeke, when he's talking about ontology, you know, he's in many ways, when you listen to John, he sees both sides and he is living in the spirit of finesse because, well, maybe it's both and, because so many of these things seem to be both and. And so we look at Kant, but then if Kant is totally right, then why do our bridges stay up? And why is engineering so powerful? But Kant has a point. And so we're finding a lot of both and with John Vervaeke, and with good reason, because either extreme doesn't seem to hold right. So now you've got matter down below and you've got mind on top. And you have to ask the question, what is the best way to approach each realm? Well, the best way to approach mapped territory is with the spirit of mathematics. And the best way to approach unmapped territory, that which is too complex for you to know, if you're not a motorcycle mechanic, you need a specialist to fix your motorcycle. If you're not a doctor, you need someone who knows more than you. And what we discover is that human beings are the most complex things that we deal with for lots of reasons. No one, which is that we ourselves are one. And so we've got the I-me problem, which I'll bring up in a minute. So there's a reason we treat people as persons, and a reason we don't treat cars as persons, and a reason we treat our pets as something in between. And there's a reason why the subtraction story has some validity and some grasp on it, but there's a reason why it doesn't fully work either. The best way to deal with mapped territory is the mind of mathematics, or the spirit of geometry. The best way to deal with that which is unmapped is treat it like a person. Now, again, if you listen to Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, the big difference between them is Sam Harris is saying, I'm not going to treat anything like a person except human beings. But we don't live that way. We don't act that way. Then you might ask, well, should we act that way? Well, maybe if we're watching each other, maybe we should do what we've always done, which is to handle things which are more complex than we can manage as the spirit of finesse. Well, what is finesse? It's mean I deal with it as I deal with a person. And I deal with people all the time. There was a homeless schizophrenic man who set up camp in a vacant lot near my home, and the neighbors started calling the police, and they called me, and I just walked right up to the schizophrenic homeless man, because I deal with schizophrenic homeless people all the time. And the neighbors were a little bit in shock. And one said, oh, you're a brave guy. Well, I deal with this all the time. It's mapped territory. I talk to people like this all the time. I approached him with the spirit of geometry because I, through a fair amount of experience, now I didn't quite know. I always treated him as a person, but I've talked with a lot of homeless schizophrenics, and I've had experience of, if I say this, I get outcomes I want. If I say this, I get outcomes I don't want. And so I've got the spirit of geometry that I'm bringing to the situation. But the person, this schizophrenic homeless man, I always respect. And that's the difference. And that's what the spirit of finesse is about. Because the spirit of finesse is an awareness that I am not the master of this situation. I cannot really apply the spirit of geometry here. It is something too great for me. It is something beyond me. I must treat this as a person with the spirit of finesse, not the spirit of geometry, because I don't know it. And that's why Matt Dillahunty talks to his lawnmower. So I act as if a person or a thing. Now, there's a deep division between persons and things in terms of our sense of meaning. And this is where it begins to connect in with the meaning crisis. That in fact, Owen Barfield begins this book. Oh, I was going to bring the books. Hang on. Now, John T. is going to say, well, that's not the cover of the book I sent you. No, I had bought it like 3 days before you sent me this book. So I gave it to a guy at the meetup who seemed like he could use it. So Owen Barfield begins this book talking about the meaning crisis. There are these possible justifications. Whoops, no, that's the preface to the first edition. Let me get to the first chapter. And all the menacing signs that surround us in the middle of the 20th century, perhaps the one which fills thoughtful people with the greatest foreboding is the growing general sense of meaninglessness. It is this which underlies most of the other threats. How is it that the more able man becomes to manipulate the world to his advantage, the spirit of geometry, the less he can perceive any meaning in it? Maybe, and I think this is exactly what Peterson does when he tells someone to get it to clean their room or to take a goal or to, he's invoking the spirit of finesse. We find meaning in the spirit of finesse and engaging that which we must deal with, in a sense, as a person. Now, very quickly, after you've cleaned your room, you will learn the methodology, and the spirit of geometry will take over. And the next time you clean your room, you'll do it again and again. And in that sense, cleaning your room is a fairly simple thing. It's a fairly manageable thing. But far greater things, such as, well, I've been married 31 years, and my wife continues many days to be a black box, and many days I continue to be a black box to her, and we've lived together and as husband and wife for 31 years, and we're still black boxes to each other. And so I'll tell you, if you approach your spouse with the spirit of geometry, you will not get a happy response. You'd better approach your spouse with the spirit of finesse. And Barfield makes the point that there seems to be a relationship between these spirits and our sense of meaning. Now, in this other book, The Discarded Image, which I'm sure I'll mention in upcoming videos too, Byrne Power noted it was his favorite book of Lewis. I inherited many books from my father and grandfather. I have multiple copies of a number of C.S. Lewis's books, and none of them had ever bought this. And I think the reason is because this book is different from Lewis's other books. Lewis's Christian apologetic books, Lewis is sort of a master who's dispensing wisdom to his pupils. This book is much more of an exploration where Lewis shows an incredible breadth of reading in ancient and medieval literature to illuminate the culture behind it. And now that I'm reading Owen Barfield and Lewis at the same time, oh, these two were talking back and forth because they're sharing language and they're addressing the same terms. The saving of appearances, which is something from Milton, which I've got the other book sent to me by John T. in my backpack, which I'm also working through. And so I'm getting into their minds and I'm approaching them with the spirit of finesse because, oh my goodness, I don't know so much. And Lewis makes the point that the medieval world borrowed heavily from the pagan world to develop this model of the universe that resisted scientific change and that the poets and the philosophers continue to deal with, and it dripped with meaning. Because in a sense they loved going through long and, as Lewis said, awfully dull explanations, not really explanations, but cataloging of the world in medieval literature that we read and we find horribly dull. Well, why do we find it dull and they found it so interesting? Well, because we tend to be looking for tools. And they were approaching the world with the spirit of finesse and bit by bit. And so their world was full of meaning. We approach the world with the spirit of geometry. And when, in sort of a Kantian way, when we find that the world isn't laying itself open to us, dare I say, nature not spreading her legs to us, I know some people will be offended by what I just said, we approach it with the spirit of geometry, because we want to make nature our whore. Lewis often calls nature our sister. And it shows two different aspects, two different approaches to the world, and in many ways that the spirit of geometry has within it the implicit spirit of domination that Tolkien, you know, very much embodies in Sauron and Saruman after he flips, and the mechanization of the world. We want to turn the world into geometry so that we can have our way with it. And that's what we do to people when we make people into objects and we treat people with the spirit of geometry. And now we want to apply the spirit of geometry to people. And this is dangerous ground, which Lewis very much brings up then into the abolition of man. Because, well, okay, we're going to map ourselves. We're going to be transparent to ourselves with the spirit of geometry so that what, really? A keyboard. So Barfield writes this, and I just read it actually. Most people are well aware that with the advent of the scientific revolution about 300 years ago, the mind of man began to relate itself to the world around an entirely new way. The habit then first arose of meticulously observing the facts of nature. Now I got to do a word of words that fudge on the word nature, because sometimes nature, and again, this is what we're, in a sort of a Kantian way, is this the filter we're imposing on it? Sometimes when we say the word nature, we mean a fixed thing out there that predictably responds to our mind, our spirit of geometry. Sometimes when we talk about nature, it's this life-giving mother goddess. Now this gets into Verveke's romanticism, because romanticism will very much bring back nature as personified, where we approach with the spirit of finesse. Barfield makes the point. The habit we first arose when meticulously observing the facts of nature and systematically interpreting them in terms of physical cause and effect. And this habit has been growing ever since, with incalculable and largely beneficial results for the accumulation of practical knowledge, or knowledge enabling the manipulation of nature. So again, if nature is an object that is ours to manipulate, towards our end, we approach her with the spirit of geometry. If nature is a sister, a mother, we approach her with the nature, with the spirit of finesse. Because we might learn that, and when we're getting into the meaning crisis and forces and factors, now Theus will perhaps say, well, the application is obvious with respect to God, and we'll get there in a minute. But what about all of the internal combustion engines we thought we were making conveyances to get from A to B? And as Jordan Peterson, one of my favorite places in his classroom lecture, when he says, no, a car is a thing which reorganizes city landscapes and converts fossil fuels into CO2. That's what a car is. In fact, 300 years from now, the question of what is a car? Oh, it's a way I get to the movie theater. Or it's a way that we fill the atmosphere with CO2. And I know I'm going to get comments about this. It's the way that we put, you know, more CO2 into the oceans as it absorbed it. Well, I'm applying, in a sense, the spirit of geometry in making those conclusions. But the question is then, should I approach nature with the spirit of geometry or with the spirit of finesse? Because finesse has built in with the time, I'll do this and then I'll wait and see. And I'll do this and I'll wait and see. And I'll do this and I'll wait and see. That's how we deal with people. And when you don't deal with people in that way, they don't like it. That's Peterson's point he makes again and again. Now, the point that Lewis makes is that we've jettisoned one model for another. And I didn't include the portion here, but in the epilogue to this book, Lewis begins and says, which is the epilogue is one of the most important. So if you get to the end of the book and you don't read the epilogue, you've missed probably one of the best parts of the book. I made no serious effort to hide the fact that the old model, and I'll talk about this more, this medieval model of the world, which gave people so much meaning, and even while they were living terribly difficult, painful lives. Remember what Peterson says again. We address suffering with meaning. Meaning is one of the chief tools that we have against suffering. I have no serious effort to hide the fact that the old model delights me, as I believe it delighted our ancestors. Few constructions of the imagination seem to me to have combined splendor, sobriety, and coherence to the same degree. It is possible that some readers have long been itching to remind me that it had a serious defect. It was not true. I agree. It was not true. But I would like to end by saying that this charge can no longer have exactly the same sort of weight for us that it would have had in the 19th century. We then claimed, as we still claim, to know much more about the real universe than the medievals did, and hoped, as we still hope, to discover yet more truths about it in the future. But the meaning of the words know and truth in this context have begun to undergo certain changes. And then he gets to the end of this, and he says, talks about the models, and he makes the point. I hope no one will think that I am recommending a return to the medieval model. I am only suggesting considerations that may induce us to regard all models in the right way. Respecting each, treating each with the spirit of finesse, respecting each and idolizing none, we are all very properly familiar with the idea that every age the human mind is deeply influenced by the accepted model of the universe. But there are two-way traffic. The model is also influenced by the prevailing temper of the mind. Thomas Kuhn made this point after Lewis. We must recognize that what we have been called a taste in universes is not only pardonable but inevitable. We can no longer dismiss the change of models as a simple progress from error to truth. No model is a catalog of ultimate realities, and none a mere fantasy. Each is a serious attempt to get in all of the phenomena, to try to save the appearances, to get in all of the phenomena known at a given period, and each succeeds in getting a great many. But also, no less surely, each reflects the prevalent psychology of an age almost as much as it reflects the state of that age's knowledge. And so there we come to terms a bit with Kant's prison of the mind. Hardly any battery of new facts would have persuaded the Greeks that the universe had an attribute so repugnant to him as infinity. Hardly any such battery could persuade a modern man that it is hierarchical. It is not impossible that our own model will die a violent death, ruthlessly smashed by an unprovoked assault of new facts, unprovoked by the Nova of 1572. But I think it is more likely to change when and because far-reaching changes in the mental temper of our descendants demand that it should. The new model would not be set up without evidence, but the evidence will turn up when the inner need for it becomes sufficiently great. It will be true evidence. But nature gives, most of her evidence in answer to the questions we ask her. Another tip of the hat to Kant, perhaps. Here, as in the courts, the character of evidence depends on the shape of the examination, and a good cross-examiner can do wonders. We will not indeed elicit falsehoods from an honest witness, but in relation to the total truth in the witness's mind, the structure of the explanation is like a stencil. It determines how much of that total truth will appear and what patterns it will suggest. Now, turning to Barfield's first essay in this, he writes about, you know, similar things, the, you know, what it took for that old model to be upended and for that new model to come into play. And of course, Barfield will go into questions of the language behind it. Verveke makes the point at the changing of the universe with Galileo that the math was better, and almost always it's forgotten in that conversation that, well, the church, the Bible lost against Galileo. Galileo wasn't fighting against the Bible. Galileo was fighting against the old model, which was based on Ptolemy and Aristotle. That's where the old model came from in the medieval period. The facts fit the model we are attempting to pursue. And we see this all the time. We see this all the time with each other. We have this in our political fights. Well, is big government or small government? Is abortion murder or not? On and on we go. We grab the facts to fit the model. Why are we choosing the model? There's the question. Because if you go back to Verveke's other excellent, other sideline video in his meaning series where they talk about zombies, I versus me. This gets into that there's I, and you can illustrate this. I am eating. I am the agent who is doing the eating. Or she is feeding me. Well, me, then I'm this object that is receiving something. I am the agent doing something. And with the self-transcendence, and this is part of the point that Barfield makes, it takes a while till we get to the point, you know, he makes the point that, well, okay, positivism comes around, but it takes a while till we get to the point that we can do the I-me thing. Which gets into Brett Weinstein's, well, I will reprogram my robot programming. You can't be both the agent. I fed me. I and me are not exactly the same thing in that sentence. Now, Jordan Peterson made the point, which I made a few moments ago, that people don't like being treated with the spirit of geometry. Oh, they hate it. They hate it fast. We default to personifying that which we must treat with our mind of finesse. Get locked in a cage with a tiger. Well, maybe if you've been in a lot of cages with tigers, you can approach it with a spirit of geometry. But if not, and even if you have been locked in a lot of cages with lions and tigers, as that one Vegas performer learned, you'd better approach it with a spirit of finesse. You approach the animal with a degree of respect that affords him a degree of personhood. Not all the way up to a human being, but at least a serious animal. We look hungry to use our mind of geometry. Why? Because it's a tool. That's really the difference. We discovered our power and the power of tools to deliver the outcomes we desire. And if we have to break a few eggs along the way, well, so be it. Until we discover that the whole system, in fact, probably required a spirit of finesse rather than geometry in some cases, because we didn't really know what we were doing. This is the absolute best way to move forward. Now, I've been wanting to do some talk about Martin Luther and Luther and Rasmus. One of the interesting things about Luther and Rasmus is you get into these questions about what is the Bible and whether the Bible is this thing that must be regarded with purely a spirit of finesse. But Erasmus kind of brings it down to us and says, we can apply some geometry to this textual criticism, and we understand some of these processes, and so we're going to apply textual criticism and try and get something perhaps closer to the author autographs by sifting through all of these competing texts and taking out some of these verses that it seems pretty clear to the spirit of geometry that they shouldn't have been here. Now Luther comes about, and in many ways, now God isn't something which is delivered to us by an institution, but God is something which is delivered to us by the Holy Book, and directly by the Holy Spirit through the book. But built into Luther's plan is also, well, then the spirit of geometry will take over in the reading of the book. And so that's how, through this new process, we'll have uniformity. Whereas before, the uniformity was hoped to be gained by the tyranny of power exercised by the Roman Catholic Church. If you're a heretic, you will be burned. Now, when we hear that in our culture, we hear burning just as a painful way to kill somebody. But if you understand burning at the stake in, let's say, a mind that is created by the Old Testament and understanding what an altar is and what a sacrifice is, it actually has quite a bit more symbolic resonance that you don't burn someone because you want to cause them a painful death. That might be one of your motivations. What you actually do is subjugate them to a trial by fire and see if God will deliver him. Now, of course, in the story of Christ's crucifixion, that gets inverted because the mockers say to Christ, he saved others, he cannot save himself. But obviously, within the narrative of the story, he is saving others by not saving himself. But every burning of a heretic is conducting a trial by fire. And that's why books themselves will burn. If the book survives the burning, well, then it must be, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it must be approved by God, and then there will be revelation. But they're all approaching the universe with the spirit of finesse. So this is where I think we get to the question of the answer where we started. Did I not make a slide? No, I didn't make a slide. Wait a minute. I did make a slide. What is God? This is where we started with Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris. What is God? And I've talked before about God number one and God number two. God number one is the immanent God. The world is full of his glory. And this, there's all of this world, this predictable God in the Hebrew Christian framework, where the world is orderly because God is orderly. It's very Platonic in that sense. And the world is full of his glory. So we can apply the spirit of geometry to our crops and to many things, but we can only apply it so far because we recognize that behind this world that we see all around us is in fact a God number two that we have to approach with the spirit of finesse, because that God is holy, holy, holy. And you find this in the Bible all the time. They approach God in fear and trembling. Moses is passing by and there's a burning bush. And he approaches it with the spirit of finesse because the bush is burning, but it's not consumed. Well, you better approach that with the spirit of finesse and not with the spirit of geometry, because you better approach it with a black box. Now, some of what we can approach with our mind, the glory with our mind of geometry, and we can count the grains of sugar that can be put into the cake, or the grains of salt that can be put into the soup. In fact, part of the mandate, the culture, go out and have dominion over the earth, is an invitation to apply the mind of geometry to the world. But it's always within a framework of the left brain, which is the spirit of finesse, where we are small and we stand as not finally owners, but subregents of the world. The ultimate of everything is God, and it cannot be mastered by our minds. We can't even master another human being by our minds. We must approach that mind with finesse, mind open to time, because what will happen to this God? Well, this is, of course, where revelation comes in, because the God is revealed, and the heart of the God is revealed, and Jesus, it's all the spirit of finesse when you read the Bible, and it's you're dealing with a person. So this is really, did I not make another slide? Oh, I didn't make another slide. Why aren't my buttons working like I want them to? Oh, no, that's not where I wanted to go. This is where I wanted to go. Come on, come on. What? Pause. I'm not going to wrangle with my computer. This is where we go with this conversation. You look down into the void. Here's the question. Here's the question that is dividing intelligent design. Now, I'm not endorsing that framework because I don't know anything about the framework. So don't say, ah, oh, you're endorsing it. The question is the universe a product of mind or is it an emergent product of chaos? Well, what do you mean by chaos? You mean arbitrary. There is no pattern to it. That's what you mean by random. Or do we approach a process that we can't distinguish between? And we do this all the time. Is this intention or randomness? We do this with people all the time. Does that person hate me? Did they try to hurt me? Or were they simply mindless and not paying attention at the moment? That's why we treat persons as persons with the spirit of finesse. Because it's unmapped territory. And so the question then is, Sam, how should you approach what has always been called God, which is absolutely everything and then way more, far beyond what we can understand, that which is holy, holy, holy? You're going to approach it with the mind of geometry? That's a bad move. That's a stupid move. You want to approach it with the mind, the spirit of finesse, because you don't know. Well, then, once you realize you don't know, you want to somehow gain more knowledge so you can approach it with the spirit of geometry. And that is, in fact, it's right in this space that religion works. But the main question you have to ask is, how are you going to relate to the universe? And by simply applying the spirit of geometry or the right brain to the universe is foolish because you don't know. And in fact, in that moment, Sam Harris says he didn't know. Maybe that's the best way to go right now. There we go. Bad video maker. Come on.
So, yeah, but that doesn't open the door. I mean, that one thing we can know with absolute certainty is that whoever wrote the Bible didn't know either. And there's many other things he or she didn't know, like...
Which is why you use the spirit of finesse. Which is why... So here's the question that I've been... You know, why... What about personhood? And the answer that I have is, if you are dealing with something which is greater than you, and we know this, we apply the spirit of finesse. Well, maybe you're going to get out and lift up the hood and wiggle a wire. That's the spirit of finesse. You're going to try to approach it. You're going to apply the spirit of geometry. Well, I tried this and it didn't work. Well, this is in a sense what religion is. But religion is also all of the answers that people have been giving you along the way. And are you going to listen to them? And so the question between God number one and God number two is, the earth is full of his glory, so apply the spirit of geometry, be fruitful and have dominion over the earth. You're a mind, have dominion over matter. But when you do this, always bear in mind that this is within a far larger framework, which is God number two, where you have to approach it with the spirit of finesse. And that's, in a sense, where a lot of these things go. Now, what's interesting, if you swing back to my conversations with Nathan Jacobs and the nuns and the duns, people in a sense are rejecting a certain spirit of geometry that the church has foisted upon them, and they want a spirit of finesse. And that's not a bad motivation. But the question then is, why do they want it mechanistic and not personhood? Right there, you're right in the middle of the category again. And, well, the answer to that would be, well, if you can't answer impersonal or personal in terms of your cosmology and your worldview, The best thing you can approach it with is the spirit of finesse, which is what Verizon Lisa does, which is why people, when they reject organized and formal religions, most of them do not just fall back into the spirit of geometry, because it doesn't work. And they will again default back into the spirit of finesse, which will usually lead them into what they call spirituality, trial and error. Let me try these crystals. Let me try these practices. Let me try these things. Let me try those things. It's a rejection in a sense of the spirit of geometry when applied to the greatest questions. But one might think, well, maybe you should listen to what others have been saying. So this video didn't quite end up. I had it all in my mind. It hasn't really fleshed out as I want to. But I'm making progress on via Pascal here and via this way of seeing the brain and how it's lining up. I'm making progress on answering the question of personhood. Why God number two? Well, because number one, you are made to approach God number two as a person. You are made to approach the absolute ultimate of the universe, of the everything, with the spirit of finesse as a person, not with the spirit of geometry. This will come up in more videos, but I hope something clear came out of it.